within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and this week I'm lucky enough to have a fellow podcaster on my podcast. So my guest this week, her name's Noni Boone, and she has a podcast called Speak Your Truth with Noni Boone. But Noni is one of those people that's had a lifetime of different experiences. You know, she was aerobics instructor for a long time, and then she was into corporate graphic design, and her journey led her to become a speaker and success coach. Noni started this podcast called Speak Your Truth, Noni Boone, because she wanted to share all the topics she covered studying holistic counseling, archetypes, and chakras. She also wrote a book called Holofest, which is about how to manifest holistically using your mind, body, and spirit. And, you know, normally on the podcast, I just focus on people's journeys, how they got to the point they got to. But when Noni started talking about these archetypes, I got really interested in them. And I spent quite a bit of time actually asking her about them, having her explain them to me. And I'm actually so glad I did, because I learned quite a bit in this podcast. And I'm sure you guys will too, listening to the amazing Noni Boone. Noni Boone, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Ah, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here today.
I'm excited to have another fellow podcaster on the podcast. So you, we might start with your podcast, because I never really get to talk to podcasters, and we'll get into your whole journey here in a bit. But so your podcast is called Speak Your Truth, is that correct?
Yeah, Speak Your Truth with Noni Boone. And I decided to do the podcast because I studied holistic counseling about 16 years ago now. And I remember sitting in the classroom and just going through these incredible subjects and thinking to myself, why is this not taught in school? This is just something that everybody should be taught. And looking at my sons, I have three sons, and just watching them go through their education and thinking to myself that so much of what they're taught is just kind of useless fodder. And I understand it. I get it. One of my best girlfriends is a school teacher, so we have conversations about this. And school is really preparation for life in terms of gaining the skill of being able to remember a lot of information and regurgitate it. So comprehension, remembering, comprehending, and a lot of the things that you learn you won't ever use again. I certainly, when I go through my 14-year-old's homework, I look at it and think, I can't even remember learning that. And half the time he's way smarter than me and I can't even work out how to do it. I have to Google, so particularly with the maths. But I just learned these subjects at college and I thought everybody should be taught this. It's such valuable information. So I put the podcast together so that I could pass on that information to people, make it available for everybody to be able to listen to those topics and subjects. So the podcast is pretty much everything that I learned at college and before, because I also go through archetypes and chakras, which was a bit of extra learning that I did before I studied holistic counseling. So it's all there. It's all there on my podcast.
We'll get to that stuff here in a minute. Okay, so tell us, what exactly is holistic counseling? Yeah, let's start there. What exactly is holistic counseling? I like the sound of it already.
Yeah, well, anything holistic, of course, is looking at the whole person. So you're counseling somebody and you're taking into account everything about them, mind, body, spirit, environment, their connections, their family. So you look at the person as a whole, and that's where holism comes from. Mm. So it's a style of counseling which really appealed to me, because I think we are three-dimensional and that all needs to be taken into account when working with a person.
Right. So you casually mentioned there a second ago, this stuff should have been taught in school. And then you said, you know, that your podcast is about all the things that you learnt that you think we should have been taught. You know, you've listened to, you told me you've listened to some episodes of my podcast, and I had to do a bio here recently, and I was trying to explain exactly what the podcast is about. And it just hit me that really it's about people's journeys to how they got to the place they are now, which is not the worldview that we're taught in the first place. So really the podcast, my podcast for me, is about people sharing their stories of how they unraveled the cultural and societal conditioning that was put on us and is actually holding us back. And it sounds to me like, you know, what you're talking about, things that we should have been taught in school, you know, what you get taught in school is the cultural and societal conditioning that holds you back. So what do you think we should be taught in school?
And I think also the school system is really very much about children being fed information rather than being taught to think for themselves and being taught to question things. So it's a little bit counterproductive in that sense. I think that in school we should be taught life skills. We should be taught how to invest money. We should be taught how to save. We should be taught how to negotiate relationships. We should be taught how to develop our self-worth, our self-esteem, all of those valuable qualities that help us to succeed in life rather than learning about, well, I think history is important. We need to look at history, but then you've got to ask who writes the history books and how accurate is the history. And then that's just probably a whole another podcast. Start getting into all the conspiracy theories, which is quite often some form of truth, really.
Yeah, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but I do think that the way that kids are taught at school is so that they become a cog in the machine and definitely not free thinkers.
Absolutely. It's all about really all of us just being little ants and going to the factory.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that in, you know, you're in Australia, I'm here in the US, and I'm not saying that the politicians or whoever's making up the rules now even knows they're doing it or why they're doing it, because that's their cultural and societal conditioning. But if you go back far enough, there was an agenda, and it might have been back in the Middle Ages or even before. But you think about, you know, I'm really into like Indigenous stuff, and you think about, you know, that the church back in the day, you know, like you can't get your information or your inspiration from anybody else. You have to get it from us. You know, they were, you know, I think it was the church that disconnected our head from our body sort of thing, you know. And with what you're on about, this whole holistic counselling thing, I imagine it's all about, you know, putting all that back together.
And I think also having a sense of spirit and knowing who you are, knowing the fact that we have a soul, the fact that we have a spirit, whereas religion is very much about you can talk to God, but you have to go through a priest to be able to do that. And you have to attend a church and be part of a congregation in order to do that. And for me, I was raised Catholic. I went to a Catholic school.
Me too.
And so for me, my concept of God was a man in the sky that was judgmental, and I had to behave, otherwise I was a naughty girl, I was a bad child. So that was pretty much my kind of upbringing until I got to a point where I read Neil Donald Walsh's book, Conversations with God, and that completely changed my concept of what I believed God to be. And I then realized that it was just something that I could have, it was a force larger than me that I could have a relationship with, that I could have a dialogue with by myself all day, every day. And my church became a rock that I would jog to when I lived in New South Wales. And I'd jog way out into the bush. It was kilometres out. There was not a soul around. And I had a favourite rock that I would sit on and just contemplate my life, just think about and reflect and think about what I wanted to achieve, what my goals were. And that was where I had my conversations with what I perceived to be God. And that relationship grew into being the most important relationship in my life and still is.
So there's got to be a turning point, though. So you grew up Catholic, and at some point in time, something caused you to pick up that book. What caused you to consult that book? Was it a recommendation from someone? Was it a kind of a knowing recommendation?
A friend. I feel very much when it comes to books that when the student's ready, the teacher appears. So I was obviously ready at that point in my life. I was ready for something more, and a friend recommended it, and then I read it, and then I read the whole series. So and then I went along actually to a talk that Neil Donald Walsh came to Australia, and I went to a talk of his, and then I co-authored a book that he wrote a chapter in and I wrote a chapter in many years ago called Pebbles in the Pond. So, yeah, it's been a massive journey, such an incredible journey as well.
Okay, let's not skip over that bit. So you've been going along through life. Someone suggests you read a book. Mm. Not only do you read the book, but somehow, sometime in the future, you end up writing a chapter of a book with the guy whose book changed your life. How'd that come to be? And how, looking back on that, do you kind of like pinch yourself and you're kind of like you're incredulous about things like that, or you just kind of like, yeah, that's how it happens?
I was really wowed about it initially. I thought, because people call it coincidence, whereas I call it synchronicity. And I feel that when you really connect with yourself in a really positive way, that life and the universe just aligns with you, and you get signs and symbols along the way that, if you just are brave enough to listen to it and believe it and trust it, it will take you on the right path. So I was down in Thredbo. I love skiing, and we go to Thredbo pretty much every year and have a little bit of an Australian ski, which is quite ridiculous. When you've skied in other parts of the world, like I have been lucky enough to do, Thredbo is just like a little dot on a mountain of snow, but it's better than nothing.
Can I just interrupt
you
for a second?
Yeah.
Fun fact. Australia, because we have so little snow, was the first country that had snow skiing as something to entertain you, like as a something to fun to do.
Yeah.
Everywhere else, it was a mode of transportation.
Ah,
Australia was the first place that had it as a as an activity.
As a sport.
As a sport or, something that you do for fun.
It's a leisure.
It's not part of your daily work. You know, think about, we both have horses. Think about at some point in time, your horse was your mode of transportation. Like you rode a horse.
Absolutely.
To get somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, skiing apparently was the same way everywhere else except Australia.
Yeah, that makes sense actually, because, they would have. And I've spoken to people who used to ski to school in their childhood. In the same way that people used to ride a horse to school.
Right. Not from Australia, though.
So, yeah. No.
Sorry. Sorry to interrupt. No. So, you're telling us about your Thredbo story.
Yeah. So, then I went into a little, there's a gorgeous little homeware store in Thredbo Village. And I walked in there, and just on the table as I walked in, there was a little stack of books called Pebbles in the Pond. And I picked it up, and one of the authors, it's an anthology, so there's lots of different contributing authors, and one of the authors lived in Thredbo. So I bought a copy of this book just to support the local community and started reading it. And then the next thing, I ended up reaching out to one of the other authors in the book and doing some business coaching with her. She lived in Spain, Christine, and then I ended up going over to Spain and meeting her. And then I ended up they were bringing out another version of the book, Pebbles in the Pond, Wave 2, and I put up my hand to contribute to that book, and I did. So that's kind of how it all fell into place. And it was quite incredible. There was a group of us that contributed to the book, and then we came from all different parts of the world, and then we ended up going to stay in a mansion in Baltimore and having 5 days together so that we could all meet each other. And that was incredible.
You know, we've just come back from our second annual podcast summit in San Antonio, Texas. So we, the first year we had 22 of the first year's guests present there. This one we had 20 of them there. And it's a bit like that. But what I was going to say was one of them talked about, well, in their presentation, they talked about, you just said there's no, you don't believe in coincidences, you think they're synchronicities. Well, one of the slides up on the screen said there are no synchronicities. There are only miracles.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the same sort of thing really, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about just, it's following that guidance. We get this kind of intuitive guidance. And I think if we can learn to tap into that, and a lot of the time people question it. So they might get like a little download of, you should really move to this country or move to this state or change jobs or change careers, or you're really not quite in the right relationship. And quite often we hear that little voice of intuition, and it's usually telling us to do something that we don't want to do or something that's hard. And so that's why we then talk ourselves out of it. But if we can learn to trust it and listen to it, even if it is telling us to do something that's really scary or something that you don't see how all those dots could join together, or you can't see the path clearly, or it's going to really ask something big of you, if you can step up and do it, I guarantee that it will take you somewhere amazing and it will be miraculous.
Yeah, so you've gone from, you know, growing up and going to Catholic school and thinking of miracles as one thing, and now you've kind of been through a bit of a journey, and now you look at miracles as something else. Let's unravel your journey to that point, because you've been a few things. You've been you're a fitness coach, I think, and then you're a corporate graphic designer.
Yep.
How did you get into the and I think it was fitness coach, correct me if I'm wrong. How did you get into doing that?
Yeah, no, you're right. When I was 18, I loved going to the gym. I've always been into health and fitness. So I did the ACHPA certificate course back then, which was all that you had to really do to become a personal trainer. It was like a 2-week full-time course. And I worked in the advertising industry. I really liked that industry. There's a creative aspect to me. And I think to understand really why people have a lot of different jobs and careers and do a lot of different things is because we have a lot of different archetypes. So archetypes are blueprints, they're archetypal patterns, and they're contracts that we come into this world contracted to do certain things. So for example, the artist is an archetype. So if you have the artist archetype like I do, you'll probably do something along the lines of drawing or painting or graphic design, or you'll do something artistic. If you have the mother archetype, then maybe you'll do something that's really goes deep into the mother, which is maybe fostering children or working in daycare or doing something that really puts you in the arena with children on a grander scale than perhaps just being a parent yourself. So these archetypes call to us, and the athlete archetype is another archetype that I have. So instead of being a professional athlete, I satisfied that part of myself, that archetypal part of myself, by getting involved in the fitness industry and becoming a personal trainer and an aerobics instructor. And that was back in the 80s when aerobics was quite new and exciting. And I used to teach classes and get up on a podium with my hair up in a high ponytail and leg warmers and tights and G-string and the whole, I think in America they call it a thong. And whole look back then.
Yeah, my wife was an aerobics instructor when I met her too.
Was she?
Yeah, she was into step.
That's
aerobics
awesome.
At the time.
Yeah. I used to do that, Reebok step. Yeah. So I worked at Healthlands at Bondi, and I actually met my husband in the gym. So that was also part of the synchronicity of that journey. And yeah, so then after doing that for many years, I eventually wanted to satisfy the artist in me. So I studied graphic design when my two first sons were quite young. And I had a corporate graphic design business for many years. I still do a bit of graphic design. I still do the odd logo or little jobs if people ask me. I'm still open to doing it and keep my skills up. I don't want to lose those skills. So it's something that has also come in very handy for me with different businesses that I've done throughout the years. So I also had an adjustment business. I had a property with 15 acres of beautiful arable land. So I put in an arena and I had some clients come and adjust horses. So I looked after anywhere up to 18 or 20 horses.
Oh, wow. So a few people from other countries. So in America, that would be a boarding facility.
And yes.
In England, that would yes. be a livery. So it's a place where people pay you to keep, yep. Keep their horses. And I'm not sure what it might be in I think it's adjustment in New Zealand, and I'm not quite sure what it is in maybe Western Europe, but in the UK, at least it's a livery.
Yeah. So that was fabulous because I met some great people. I learned a lot about horses. And I had a great time doing that. It was just a way of utilizing the property that we lived on and bringing people to the property so that I had people to ride with and people to have some horse fun with. So that was really terrific. So, yeah, I have done a lot of different things, and most people do. Most people do explore their archetypes in some way, shape or form. And the child archetype can manifest in many ways, and the nature child is usually comes through somebody who has a deep connection with animals. And I imagine you have the nature child, Warwick, which is what guides you and inspires you to want to work with horses.
You've kind of jumped right into these archetypes right here. And so I want to unravel that a bit more in a minute. But at the time that you were the personal trainer, and then you were doing the graphic design, did you know that was your archetype, or did this learning come later?
No, I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know. No, I didn't. It was just, again, just following whatever drew my attention, whatever I felt excited about or found joy in doing.
And so the archetype stuff, did you learn about that in the holistic counselling, or did it come from some other direction?
No, it came from another direction. And then it was reinforced when I studied psychology, because Carl Jung was the first person to really theorize archetypes. And then I read a book called Anatomy of the Spirit, written by Carolyn Mace, who was a medical intuitive.
I need to write
and
this down.
That's an amazing book, actually. I think it's probably, I haven't included it in my books list of what I want to go through with you today, but it is definitely one of the great books that I have read in my life. And Carolyn Mace is an amazing teacher, and again, someone that I've been and seen live and followed for many, many years. So she theorized archetypes in a way that makes it really understandable and talks about sacred contracts and how we come into this world. There are basically four what she calls survival archetypes, which is the child, the victim, the prostitute, and the saboteur. And we all have those. All of us have those four archetypes. And they're basically the ones that help us to navigate life. And then on top of that, we have eight individual archetypes, which is what then they're like a force within us that drive us. If you talk about what you see people that are very driven to do something, what is it in them that drives them to do it? It's their archetypal forces. It's something that they don't even have any control over. So it's quite a fascinating study. I really enjoyed studying archetypes, and something that I still refer to a lot. And when I'm doing work on myself or really analyzing myself, quite often it's coming from an archetypal force.
Okay, I want to really get into these archetype things. We're all over the shop here, by the way. Normally I start at the beginning and work my way through, and we're just kind of all over the place. But so I have over the years become aware that myself and many people are sometimes driven by and sometimes successful because of their traumas. And and I'm sure you're aware of that too, and I'm wondering – at some point in time in this conversation, I want to kind of unpack is how do you tell the difference between someone operating off their trauma and operating off their archetype? And is the trauma given to them because of their archetype? Like you have this soul contract when you come in, this is your archetype, But there's got to be circumstances to shape you to do that. And for, have you ever read a book or heard of a book called The Masks of Masculinity by Lewis Howes?
No, so you talk, but I've heard you talk about it.
Yeah, and so, you know, these are all ways that men mask their emotions, you know, or hide their insecurities or whatever. And one of them is the athletic mask, and one of them is the successful mask. And he talks about a lot of CEOs have a lot of trauma and shame behind their success. And I'm just wondering, you know, how much is archetype and how much is shame? And I don't know if you know the answer, but when you were talking about the eight forces that drive us, some of those are listed like, well, I actually think sometimes those things are driven by shame. So do you have any thoughts on that subject?
I think the masks that we wear and what that book is referring to is we basically all develop a personality, which is the way that we want the world to see us. And that personality is a combination of when you're growing up, there's people that come into your life that influence you and you take on parts of their personality that you like. So you might come across somebody who has a great sense of humor, that's quite a comedian, and you like that about them. So you develop that in yourself. And as you go along, you develop parts and aspects of yourself. And it's about conditioning yourself so that you present to the world the way that you want to present to the world. And that's what the mask is. And when you study psychology, you realize that we are all wearing masks. And then behind that mask is the authentic self. And the masks are often created so that we can be accepted and find approval from other people. And those masks, of course, behind those masks, yes, there can always be trauma. I think that anybody that goes through childhood goes through trauma to some degree. Of course, some people have a lot more and a lot deeper trauma than others, but childhood is a traumatic experience because it is part of what is shaping us to become who we're meant to be. It's taking us through that pyramid of Maslow's hierarchy of needs to the point where we get to self-actualization. That's the journey of life. So childhood is the foundation of that. And I think that throughout childhood, there's a lot of wounding, and the wounded child is an archetype. Yeah. And that trauma is the shadow side of the wounded child. Mm. And that's where that archetype comes into play. And also the victim. A lot of children are victimized. They're abused. They're neglected. The neglected child is an archetype as well. So definitely the archetypal forces come into play, and that's part of your story, part of your journey, and then part of your development and I suppose part of your challenge in life is to transform those archetypes. So it's about transforming the trauma, transforming. If you look at the victim archetype and say you were victimized, the transformation of that is to become victorious in spite of being victimized.
So you said, I want to go through these archetypes actually because this is fascinating. I've not heard of them before like this. You said there's four, are they basic archetypes or?
Survival, survival archetypes. Yep.
And those four are?
So there's the child, and then that child can present in many different ways, and you can be one or all of them. So there's the nature child, the wounded child, the neglected child, there's the eternal child, and that's, for example, and you see that a lot in women who just refuse to age. They will become plastic surgery addicts in order to hold on to youth. They just can't, as it says in the Desiderata, gracefully surrender the things of youth, which means grow old gracefully. And the eternal child can't do that, or they remain very immature for their entire lives. So that's the child archetype, and we all have an inner child. And when you study transactional analysis, you realize that for your whole life, there's a part of you that is a child, a part of you that is a parent, and a child, part of you that is an adult. And you'll often parent yourself in the way that you were parented until you learn to do it a different way if it doesn't serve you. And there's a part of you that if you are over 25 years of age, you have an adult part of you as well, which is the part, the adult part is of us is us having this conversation right now, you and me. We are in our adult selves. If you did something where you're chastising yourself, you're parenting yourself. If you go and do something that's really fun and spontaneous, like you jump on a ride at an amusement park, you're being a child. You're bringing out that child archetype. When I get up on my pony, I'm in my child archetype. I'm doing what I did in my childhood. And everybody, in order to be fulfilled in life, needs to do something in their life that appeals to their inner child. So what did you do as a child that you loved that you no longer do? What play did you have? What fun did you have? What joy did you have? When were you spontaneous and just delighted and completely excited by things? That's your inner child. And that part of ourselves stays with us for our entire lives. And a lot of people, they neglect it. They forget about it. They don't serve it. We have to make sure that we're always doing something that excites our inner child. So that's the child archetype. Then you've got the victim archetype. And the victim archetype is when things happen to us, where people betray us or people neglect us or people are mean to us or people take from us. That's when we can become victimized. And that's the shadow side of that archetype and the journey with that archetype, because, of course, archetypal journey is the hero's journey as well. So speaking of journeys all the time, everything is a journey. And the journey for us is transforming these archetypes and maturing them and being able to draw on the strength of the archetype rather than the weakness. So the weakness is when it falls into the shadow side. And when it does that, it runs your life rather than actually you running those archetypes and being aware of them and knowing how they can sabotage you if you let them. So having that awareness of them is really powerful, because then you can direct it in a positive way. So if something happens to you and somebody victimizes you in some way, they hurt you or they take from you, you can recognize it and you can grow stronger from it and you can become more aware and protect yourself from that happening in the future. So the strength of the victim is learning to protect yourself, learning to read the signs, learning to follow your intuition. You know, there's a little voice that says, hey, don't go down that dark laneway. That's not safe. And if you override that and you ignore it and you do it, and then you become a victim to something, a crime or something abusive or something dangerous, well, that's the shadow side of the victim archetype. So see how that little voice is there to protect you, because it actually alerts you to danger. It actually makes you aware. And so that's why the archetypes are so helpful, if we start to learn to listen to them and we start to learn to distinguish the voices that are in our heads all the time, playing out through our mind all the time. And one of my favorite archetypes is the saboteur archetype, because the saboteur is both our inner guide and our inner critic. And the saboteur archetype, when it's in the shadow form, so say, for example, it sabotages us basically. So say, for example, you decide that you're going to start a new process of getting up of a morning and you're going to go for a jog because you want to be fit. And then you wake up, the alarm goes off at 5:30 and you wake up and there's a voice in your head straight away that says, oh, I didn't sleep that well last night. I'm feeling a bit tired. Maybe I'll start it tomorrow. How about I start tomorrow? And you let yourself off the hook. That's the saboteur archetype in the shadow side. But the strength of it is when...
I got one of them, and he's a big dude. He's a big, strong dude.
Yeah. Well, I actually developed a name for my saboteur archetype. So I call that negative voice the inner critic. I call her the bitch in the basement, because she's that voice in my head that says, who are you to think that you can do this? Like, you will never succeed at that. You're a failure. You're a loser. You've never, ever been any good. Like, what do you think you're doing? You know, that voice in your head that puts you down? I call that the bitch in the basement. And when she comes out, man, is she mean. She's so horrible. And then the flip side of that, I call the angel in the attic. And that's the angel voice, the inner guide that says, come on, you can do it. You know you can do it. You are enough. because we're always born feeling like we're not enough, feeling like we're worthless, feeling that we're useless. And that's the saboteur archetype. It sabotages our lives. It sabotages our relationships. It sabotages our self-worth and our self-respect. And when you learn to understand that that's just a voice that's there and it serves a purpose as well, because sometimes it keeps us in check and sometimes it keeps our ego in check. And so you have to listen to it, but it doesn't mean that you can let it run your life. You actually have to then be able to override it if it's going to take you down the wrong path. You have to be able to discern that for yourself. And then finally, another great one is the prostitute archetype. And we all have the prostitute archetype. And the best way to discover that is to ask yourself, what would it take for you to sell your soul? What would it take for you to do something corrupt or something that hurts another person or something illegal? And usually it's money or it's power or it's position. And you see that play out a lot with people that take backhanders or with politicians or with people in the public eye or people that are in a position of power. Quite often with power comes obviously responsibility, and it also becomes opportunity. And the opportunity quite often is there for people to do things that are corrupt and unethical. And that's the prostitute archetype, where someone will sell their soul because they're doing something that goes against their conscience, but they do it anyway because they're going to get something for it, something that they want. So keeping that archetype in check is really important as well. And of course, you see the prostitute archetype play out when you see a prostitute, a working girl on the street. That's the prostitute archetype playing out in real life for you.
Yeah, that is selling your soul right there.
Yeah.
So those are the four basic ones that everybody has.
Yes.
Okay. So you said there's eight other forces that drive.
And then everybody has, there's probably about another 70 archetypes. Oh. And each person is assigned eight, what Carolyn Mace calls eight of your individual, your personal archetypes, that journey. When you are given archetypes, when you incarnate, you're given archetypes, and it's your sacred contract to complete your life with those archetypes in your psyche. So they're in your psyche.
You know what? I was just thinking with that last sentence you just said, you've come a long way from Catholic school, my girl.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's more than 70 of them, and we kind of have combinations of eight of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they do play out in life, like, for example, the king is an archetype, the queen is an archetype, the princess is an archetype, the hero is an archetype, the warrior is an archetype. There's so many of them. You think about everything that you've seen through fairy tales and nursery rhymes and all of that. That's all archetypal stories, all of those things. And then you see not everybody's going to become a queen in the sense that they wear a crown and they live in a palace, but you can still be a queen and be a queen in your own life and still function that archetype through your life without it having to be so obvious or defined that it's really lived in a very public way. The father is an archetype. The mother is an archetype. There's the clown is an archetype. Basically, everything that you can think of is an archetype.
And imagine understanding what archetype you are probably helps you be aware of your shadow sides showing up and be aware of some of those pitfalls. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I have the teacher archetype, which is why I love teaching. You have the teacher archetype, which is why you like teaching. And that archetype is what inspires you and drives you. And the teacher is also a student. That's why you love learning so much and why you love reading books and learning. Like, you're hungry for it. That's because it's driven. It's that archetype in you is driving you to do that. You don't find it hard to do you? Like, you enjoy it.
You know, one of the talents I have, so skills are learnable, talents are kind of innate, but one of the talents I have is I can explain things to people in a way that they can really understand. But that's not the talent. The talent is I don't have to work at it. I don't have to sit there and ponder it and, you know, write it out and scribble it out and do it again. And it just comes out of me.
Yeah, and that's because it's archetypal in you, whereas somebody that doesn't have that would have to work a lot harder at it. Or they might not even want to do it.
Yeah, and you see people, say, in the horse business who end up, you know, maybe teaching a lot of people and doing a lot of teaching, and that you can tell they don't like teaching.
And I really feel also that you have the healer archetype.
I've got the wounded healer archetype, don't you worry.
Yeah. Well, that's a good form of the healer, because you've been wounded and you've healed yourself, and therefore you're equipped now to heal others. And that's really powerful when the archetype comes from that place.
Well, I do think that so let's talk about the wounded healer. I do think the wounded healer can help people because they understand what it's like to do the healing and where they're coming from. But is there a healer archetype that's not a wounded healer? Like, are they coming from a different place?
Yes. Mm. Yes. But I think that I always remember the saying that nobody leaves this earth unscathed. And I really do believe that we all suffer in some way, shape or form. And quite often the suffering is self-inflicted, because it's the stories that we tell ourselves, and it's living in the past, and it's regurgitating the past, or it's marinating in it. And I think that we have some control over that, but we just have to develop the awareness that we have control over that.
Right. So be aware of the... I imagine it's being aware of the shadow side of things, isn't it?
Well, the victim archetype will tell you when it's in the shadow side, absolutely. The victim archetype will tell you that you can't, that life is cruel and things never work out for me. You know, you meet those people that everything is woe me.
Right.
And everything, you know, they're just living in that victim, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when you start and that becomes your mindset, you will create in your life, you will attract situations and circumstances that verify that for you. So you will, if you believe that you're a victim, you will definitely live your life as a victim. But you have to develop the knowledge that you can become victorious, that you can rise above it.
Right. You wrote a book called Holifest.
Holifest.
Holifest,
yeah. So,
and is that about manifesting?
Yes. Yes. So I got quite interested in the law of attraction.
Mm.
And I watched Rhonda Byrne made a movie called The Secret. Did you ever watch The Secret?
I listened to the audio book, and for me that was kind of the start of this whole journey I'm on. I think up to that point in time I don't know if I was a woe is me or not, but yeah, it really got me interested in this stuff. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. But I did see the movie as well.
Yeah. So you obviously understand that this world it's a creative space that we're living in. We're creative beings and we create our lives, and our thought force and our mind is a very, very powerful tool in all of that. So if we can learn to direct that and in a positive way and use it, then it can become quite an amazing accessory in our lives. And I became quite interested in the law of attraction, and I went back to the beginning of it, sort of when it first started, which was around about 1960s. And there was a book written by Bruce McClelland called, and it was all about the power of thought force. And he started to look around at what it was that made people successful, because he was kind of struggling in his own life and wasn't really doing that well. And he saw these other men having quite successful lives, and he he sort of asks the question, well, what is it that's different about them and how are they living their lives in a way that I'm not? Because obviously things are working out for them and things aren't working out for me. And so he wrote a book called Prosperity Through Thought Force, and he decided to implement some of the things that they were doing, which was basically to work on his character and to develop himself in a way that made him more attractive, and then obviously to control his thoughts. Controlling his thoughts was one of the big ones. And it doesn't mean that you have to every day think positive thoughts, but if you can, it's definitely powerful and helpful. But to be able to determine through your thoughts what it is that you want in your life, because the thoughts have an attracting power to them, an attracting element. And there's a lot of people that have really worked in that arena, like Esther Hicks and Mike Dooley. And I started really looking into all these teachers and looking at how you can create the life that you want through using your thoughts. And what I discovered when I read Bruce's book was, and he actually said it himself in the book, that there were parts that he'd left out. And I came along and I thought, I really feel like I know what those parts are, and I'm going to write a book including what he's taught, but then bringing in the other aspects and the other parts and the things that I think that he left out. So Hollyfest is about how to create and how to manifest holistically, which is using your mind, your body, and your soul. Because you can want something as bad as anybody could want something, but if it's not aligned with your soul and it's not meant for you, you're not going to have it. It's not going to come to you. And so the book that I wrote was all about how to attract in the most powerful way and manifest the life that you want using your mind, body, and soul, and the whole understanding of that, the whole process, the whole creative process, what you've got to do. And then I developed these 21 virtues that you can develop in yourself to strengthen your character, to become the best possible version of yourself. Because I really think, you know, if you go through life being an a-hole, you're not going to attract a good life for yourself. And a lot of people go through life being an a-hole. You know, they're not very nice people. They don't really work on themselves. They're not really conscious and aware of who they're being or how they're operating. And those people, they might look successful from the outside because they might have fancy cars and a house with a view or whatever it is that they might have, but it doesn't mean that they're successful, because really I feel and I believe that success is inner peace and it's freedom. That's success in a nutshell. And a lot of people that have material wealth and have fame and fortune and all of those things, they're not free and they're not at peace.
All right. Have you ever heard of a guy named Jake Ducey?
No.
He was a young guy, wrote a book, he wrote a book about manifesting, really, and he was a student of Jack Kornfield's. Not necessarily a student,
yes, I know
of
Jack.
Him, but he made himself a student of Jack Kornfield's teachings. Yep. And actually got to meet Jack Kornfield one time, and Jack, he really made an impression on Jack, and I think Jack wrote the foreword for his book. And he published his book when he was like 21 or something. I think it was called Into the Wind. But he started putting clips out on social media quite a long time ago. And one of them really struck me because it made me realize when I went from wishing things would happen to having things happen, you know, when manifesting really started working. And he said, because I always thought, you know, you get what you want, you get what you think about. He said, you don't get what you want. You get who you are. And that's what you were talking about there, like when you start to embody that and you know, you're not just thinking about it, but you're showing up as it. Like it's a quite a holistic, yeah, I think that whole manifesting thing is a holistic thing. Like there's a lot to it. It's not just wishing stuff would happen, because a lot of people buy a lottery ticket and wish it would happen, but it doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Exactly, because, I mean, there's quite a process to it, and that's the thing that I wanted to really point out and help to teach people, is that because a lot of the time people give up, and they usually give up when they're just on the cusp of it. You know, they're just about to break through is when they give up. And it's like, if you can just hold on, I call it the void. the void is that, and it's in the creative process as well. You hear it when writers get writer's block. It's that void of nothingness. It's when nothing happens. And that's the hardest part to endure, because that's when you really want to give up. And that's when you've got to have the stamina and resilience and endurance to be able to push through, because what you want is just on the other side of that moment when you want to give up.
You know, that plays out a lot, helping people with their horses. And I'm not saying we push horses, but, you know, people are, they're doing the work, but it's not working, and they kind of want to give up or do something else. And it's like, no, you're almost there. And imagine in personal training, like a lot of times when I'm helping people with horses, it's a lot like what personal trainers do. And sometimes the personal trainer makes you do something that you just don't think you can do. And then you realize you can. I'm not saying that's all they do, but
yeah,
you know, like one more rep, or just, you can do the, you know, whatever it is that, and you can break through some of those limiting self-beliefs. But yeah, a lot of times with horses, people, they give up because it gets tough, but it's supposed to get tough before it gives way. You know, it's, if you've ever read Mastery by George Lennon, it's about being on that plateau, you know, like you're just doing the work with no, you know, it's that whole karma yoga thing, you know, focusing on a task with no thought as to the outcome of that task. You're just doing the work, and if you just keep doing the work, at some point in time you have the breakthrough.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And it's just understanding that the creative process is a process, and you can't fast track it.
Right,
you have to go with it.
You definitely can't fast track it. Because it's a, you know, it's kind of a law of nature. Like, manifesting is basically magic, and there is real magic, but you got to know how to work with the magic.
That's it. And the law of attraction is a universal law, just like the law of gravity. So if you jump out of a tree, you're going to hit the ground. There's nothing surer. And it's the same with manifesting. If you think about something over and over and over, you think about a friend and then the next minute they call you. Or you think about something that you really want, you think about red cars, and then all of a sudden you'll see red cars everywhere you go. If you're looking to purchase something, all of a sudden you'll get, I mean, I know that the algorithms help with that as well, but even before we had algorithms and before we had social media and all those things, you just would, it would show up in your life. And that's the thing that I find, and it's something that's really guided me a lot, is following those signs and symbols, because I believe that the universe communicates with us if we pay attention. And it will be like, there's like a little roadmap that shows up, and it can just be, and I call it synchronicity, coincidence, whatever you want to call it. And it does guide you to where you're supposed to be, where you're meant to be. And I find that that's so powerful, because when you start to live your life that way and you don't doubt it and you don't question it and you just answer the call, is when you just have the most amazing time. Things just really manifest in a way that blows you away. It's things become better than you even imagined. And it's such an incredible way to live your life, because all of a sudden life becomes exciting and fulfilling, rather than coming from a place of lack. You start to step into your God-given abundance, because we are supposed to live a joyful life. We are supposed to be abundant, and we are supposed to receive, and we are not supposed to live in lack. We're supposed to live in joy and in harmony with life and with the world, with the universe.
You know, at the Journey on Podcast Summit just last weekend in San Antonio, there was a 17-year-old girl there, which was so exciting to have a 17-year-old girl listening to that sort of thing, because that can change the world.
Yeah.
It was interesting. When the 17-year-old girl came there, her mum said that, like, on the Thursday she'd been thinking about cosmetology school, and by Sunday night she was thinking about a career in neuroscience.
Wow.
Cool. But during a break, the energy there was off the charts, and, you know, the things are going off. It's amazing. And during a break, she came up to me. She said, "I have a question for you." And I'm like, "Yeah, what's up?" And she said, "How did you get here?" And I just said, "Just saying yes to the opportunities that the universe dangled in front of me. And I think, you know, like you said about manifesting, there's all these signs. And you also said about that book before, you said when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. The signs are there for everybody to see, but we're not, you know, a lot of times we're not clear enough to be able to recognize those signs that are already there. It's not like the signs are only there for some people. They're there for everybody, and you've just got to be conscious enough to
become attuned to it. Like, I'll give a little example, which I think is quite fun, is I have a horse called David who, as I said to you in my initial email, David has been my Goliath because it's been such a, and not that I want to slay him, that but he's just been a giant teacher for me in my life and a challenge. And I bred him, which was really exciting. A friend of mine is a vet and a horse breeder, and she allowed me to lease one of her mares and have the mare live on my property so that the foal could be born on my property. And her stallion Contender, who's a beautiful stallion here in Australia, his semen was used, and I actually was lucky enough to be able to do the insemination myself, which was a pretty amazing experience.
Did you do the collecting as well?
No, I didn't do the collecting.
You weren't that deep. You weren't that deep into the process.
I wasn't that deep into the process, but I did ejaculate, but there was no orgasm. But I did look at the sperm through a microscope. That was pretty amazing to actually have a look at all the little sperms.
It's always fun watching them go swim around.
Yeah, there's millions of them. That was an amazing journey. And then David was born on my property. He was actually due on my father-in-law. My father-in-law's passed away now, but I sort of said a little kind of message to the universe, and I said, if he's born on your birthday, I'll call him David and after you. And he was born on his birthday, so that's why David's called David. But and he keeps my father-in-law's name alive, which is really wonderful. David's 7 now, but I went through such a journey with him because I didn't know what I know now, because I hadn't watched your online course and I hadn't done that real horse journey. My first horse was a horse that I bought that came with an education and with impeccable manners. So I've had him for 20 years, and I didn't even know there was such a thing called groundwork, or that you had to put in these hours doing all these other things with horses. I just thought you got on a horse and rode. That's all I ever did as a kid, was I got on a horse and I rode and had fun. And so having a foal and having to go through that journey and not knowing all of those things obviously landed me in a big pile of trouble. And David became shut down, very, very shut down, to the point where I would get on him and he refused to even take a step. He refused to move. And it wouldn't have mattered what I did. And I wasn't going to try it, but I could have put a cow prodder on him and he would not have moved, I'm sure. He was just that locked, that shut down. And I was watching your course and doing all the sort of online videos, and you talked about a horse called Sherlock, and he was your shut down horse. And when I arrived at my property the next morning, I had the wheelbarrow parked outside David's paddock, and in big white letters down the side of the wheelbarrow was the word Sherlock.
I was just going to say, I've seen that wheelbarrow.
That was the brand. Have you seen it?
I've seen him in Australia. Yeah. And I was like,
yeah. And it's like, it's got to a point now where it doesn't amaze me anymore. I mean, it kind of does, but it just, that sort of thing happens so much that I kind of just laugh at it now. And it's like the universe just saying, hey, you're on the right track. You know, this is where you're meant to be. You've done the right thing. You're following the right, you're on the right journey. And I think if we can start to pay attention to the lyrics in songs, or the bumper stickers on cars, or the signs on a shop window, or whatever it might be, you know, if you're questioning something, if you're doubting, if you're looking for answers, look to the universe, because it will provide them for you if you dare to pay attention.
But what do you have to do that? You got to get out of your head And you got to be present in the moment.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And you've got to not fob it off as, oh, that's just a coincidence, or no, I'm just imagining it. No, you're not imagining it. It's actually your intuition is talking to you all the time, but it's that little soft voice that's barely audible. And the more that you pay attention to it, the more it starts to communicate and the volume goes up. And then when the volume goes up, you can hear it all the time and you don't doubt it. You don't question it anymore. You just do it. And that's when the magic happens. That's where the miracles are.
So we've covered manifesting. We've covered the archetypes. In your bio, it says that you're really into chakras. How did that come about? Where was that part of your journey? Where'd that come from?
So when I read Carolyn Mace's book, I wanted to study more about archetypes. So I actually studied with a woman in Melbourne, Gail, and she taught me more about archetypes and how to help people to discover what their archetypes are. She was the Carolyn Mace Institute here in Australia. So I did some one-on-one study with her, and another course that she offered was one in chakras. And I was quite fascinated by the chakras and how they come into play in our lives as well, the seven centers of energy, although Carolyn Mace says that there's eight chakras. There's probably more as well, but the eighth chakra hovers above our head. It's not so much, it's more our connection with the divine. Mm. So, I became quite fascinated with that. I became fascinated with our energy system and how we're basically given a certain amount of energy every day, and then how we spend it is something to pay attention to, because a lot of people expel energy on the past by regrets or beating themselves up, feeling guilt or shame. And then we have energy that we project into the future in the form of usually worry or concern or doubt or fear. So keeping our energy on board and keeping those chakras circulating, revolving at the right pace, they all need to be in alignment with each other. You can have one running too fast or too slow. And when that happens, then quite often that can create illness in the body. And that manifests as dis-ease in the body. So paying attention to our energy system and how we're spending our energy. And it's really easy to do that. You just kind of close your eyes and you go through a process of asking and focusing on the different chakras throughout the body. And it's easy to just Google online and see where those chakras are, what color they are, and then think about the colors of the chakras. And you can feel that energy point in your body, and you can feel whether it's rotating fast and sped up because you're worried and anxious, or you can feel if it's going too slow because you're losing energy from it because you're plugged into things that are not serving you, or you can feel if it's just in flow. It's in flow with your joy and with your peace of mind. And when it's all like that and it's all lined up like that is when you feel at your best. And you feel really healthy and you feel really motivated and energized.
You know, a second ago you talked about some people's energy, you know, you spend a lot of energy, you know, in the past beating yourself up. But then you said a lot of people spend a lot of energy about things in the future and worrying about stuff. And I just wanted to point out to some of you at home that might be thinking, but didn't you just tell us to manifest and think about these things? And that manifesting is not worrying about the future, is it? It's believing that it's going to happen. There's a difference between there's a difference between a lack mentality and an abundance mentality. Do you want to talk on that a little?
Definitely. And the thing about manifesting is you don't want to put your energy into trying to attract something to you. You want to be in the present moment believing that you already have it. And that's the difference. Mm. And that keeps your energy with you right here, right now, because you're not, I will be happy when I get this or achieve that or when I secure this thing that I want. It's I am happy right here, right now, And it doesn't matter to me whether I get it or I don't get it. It's not going to change who I am. And I'm not going to spend energy worrying about it or trying to draw it to me, because then you're coming from a place of lack. You're then telling the universe that you're lacking something and you need it, and you're putting energy into getting it. You don't need to do that. You need to have all of your energy on board and be in present time, and you need to believe that you already have it. That's just a matter of there's a gap in time between when it comes to you, and you've just got to be in that belief and in that mindset that it's already yours. It's already done. It's already signed. It's already delivered. It's just that there's this construct called time, which actually doesn't really even exist. But that's another whole topic. So yeah, it's quite fascinating how it all works.
And it is quite the delicate balance there, like the manifesting, like the putting it out there but not hoping it happens, knowing it's going to happen, giving up so I have a friend in Wales, I don't know if you ever heard me quote her on the podcast, but she talks about intention, attention, no tension. So intention, put the attention out there. Attention, pay attention to the opportunities that arise.
Yep.
And then no tension. You can't have any tension about the fact whether it's going to happen or not. And I think that's the place that most people struggle. And I tend to have a level of apathy, maybe you might want to call it. But I think that's kind of helpful with my manifesting, because I'm not dwelling on whether things are going to happen or not. So,
Or neediness.
Is the hard part for people, I think.
I think so too. And I think one of the greatest destroyers of love is neediness, you know, that when you need something. And I've always said that I choose and I definitely want, if I say talk in terms of my relationship with my husband, we've been married for 34 years and I love him and I want him in my life and I choose him every day, but I don't need him. There's a difference. There's nothing that I need.
Have you ever traveled?
Except for food and water.
Right. Have you ever traveled much in the US?
A little bit, yeah.
What? And I don't notice it so much anymore, but I noticed when we first got here. So if you go into, let's say, I don't know, cafe in Australia, hamburger joint, and you order, go up the counter and you order, you'd say, I'd like a, but Americans tend to say, I need a. And I just thought it was really interesting when I first moved here that it's a phrasing that most Americans have. Yeah, I needed this and I needed that. Like just ordering a hamburger or a whatever. And it struck me as an interesting choice of words when I first heard it. I haven't really dwelled on it too much, but that's something they tend to say here. You know, and it's just like Australians. I mean, Americans come to Australia and someone says, how you going? They're like, you know, by car? how am I going to get there? Yeah. You know, so I'm not saying that Americans are actually setting themselves up that way, but that's just it's talking about that want and I choose versus I need. And as I learn more stuff and hang out with cool podcast guests like yourself, I have become more aware of the choices of words that I use for things. I'm really starting to believe in the power of the intention behind words and choosing the words that I use for things, because I think that's important.
I think it's so important. And I think a lot of people, if they can just make even that little tweak in their lives of starting to pay attention to their dialogue, because dialogue is so important, especially an I am statement. If you're going to make an I am statement, make sure it's really positive, because I am tired, or I am depressed, or I am broke, or I am whatever it might be that you attach to I am. You're talking about yourself, and words are powerful because thoughts become words. Words then become habits, and then habits then shape who we are and shape the outcome in our lives. And I always pay attention to somebody when you say, how are you? And that person says, oh, I'm not bad. And I always think to myself, well, not bad as opposed to terrible, or not bad?
That's an Australian thing. Why? The Americans don't say that. Yeah. You know, Australians, how are you going? Oh, yeah, not bad. Yeah, right. You know, it's very non-committal, isn't it? It's kind of like, no, and nah, yeah means yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always say, oh, I'm great, or I'm terrific, or oh, I'm wonderful, or I try to always talk things up rather than talk things down. And yeah, it's really, really powerful. And a lot of people too, like, you really notice that they're heavy with life. Life is a burden. It's like they've got the weight of the world on their shoulders and a mountain on their back, and everything is kind of you know, they're exhaling all the time. And I get that, because I'm not criticizing. I'm not saying, hey, you should never go through periods of life like that, because we all do. I definitely have. But the difference is that I've also been conscious enough to realize that it doesn't serve me very well. And I'm basically just going to be manifesting at a very low vibration, because we're vibrating all the time. Everything around us is vibrating. It's vibrational energy is what we're living in. If you look into quantum physics, you'll discover that everything is a vibrational energy. And so you want to bring your vibration up. And how amazing is it when you meet someone who's just always positive? You know, they just have that positive disposition about them. You want to be around them, don't you? Like, they're attracting. Me. Like, you really, it's the best. I know people like that. And I envy them, because I think, wow, like, it must be amazing for that to be your default position, because my default position is kind of pretty much in the middle. Like, I'm relatively optimistic. My life is that the cup is half full rather than half empty. So I'm relatively optimistic, and people are usually either optimistic or pessimistic, and you can change pessimism. You don't have to be, it's not a life sentence. You don't have to remain pessimistic, but a lot of people are by nature, but it's something that you can improve upon. Just like we can build resilience. Resilience is something that we can actually increase in our lives as well. So, but it does come from that place of, you have to start to become conscious. Like Eckhart Tolle talks about, that you become the conscious awareness of your thoughts, of what you're saying, that you become conscious of that. And that's consciousness. That's enlightenment. That's what we're all aiming for. That's what Buddhism is all about, is becoming enlightened and becoming conscious of who we are, how we're being, and who we are being, and how we're operating our lives. And when you start to pay attention to that, and that becomes, it's like building a muscle. You know, you go to the gym, it's like gym for the brain is paying attention to your thoughts and paying attention to your vocabulary and what words you use and how you describe yourself and how you describe your life. It's so important. I love that. I love how changing that just a little bit can start to have better outcomes for you.
I recently met a podcast guest who I hadn't met before, because he lives in another country. And he was in America for a horse thing that I was at too. And after it was all over on the Sunday night, we were at the person who organized the whole horse thing, we're at their house, and there was quite the shindig going on. We were all having a good time, and some were having better times than others. But this person has this amazing energy about him, okay? He's just so positive, and he was up one end. This big kitchen table holds about 12 people. I was down one end, and he was up the other end of the table, and it was lined with people on both sides, and there was a big fella sitting near me who, you know, would make some snarky remarks about different things, and, you know, just had a bit of that going on. And this this former podcast guest up the other end, at some point in time, and this is very late at night, possibly early in the morning, the guy down near me says something, and the guy at the other end just kind of leans forward, looks down the table, and says, either be more optimistic or drink more, and just went back to his conversation. It was just he couldn't handle it anymore. It was like that vibe. Yeah. I'm not picking up what you're putting down there. Yeah. And then, you know, we've just had our podcast on it, like I said, and when you're in a room of 220 people who are all like that, the energy is pretty nuts. It's pretty cool. Like you said, you know, like you love being around people like that. And then when you can get around a group of people who are the types of people you'd want to be around all the time, it's almost like you got to come home and have a rest, because you got to have a rest to get over the experience. But yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I might ask you some of your questions now, if that's all right.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I really want to hear these. You chose what book you recommend most, and the caveat of the question is not necessarily your favorite book to read, but one that you recommend to others. And it sounds like you might have a stack of them.
Like you, I have been very much a bookworm my entire life. I started reading self-help books when I was probably about 20 years old, and I'm 54 now, so that's 34 years worth of books. And yeah, when we moved from New South Wales to Queensland, I had a big book clean out and just gave away boxes and boxes and boxes of books. I'd kept and read so many over the years, and a lot of them you forget. And I find a lot of books that you read, and it might just be one little pearl of wisdom that you get from that one book. And usually everything is pointing to the same thing, and it's just taught in a different way or explained in a different way, but the basic principles are there. And so some people explain it, and that's what I love about your course as well, is just the way that you explain things and just make it so easy to understand and relatable. So that's, I suppose, what stands out for me as well, is when I'm reading a book and the author is explaining something in a way that I really get it, and it really hits home and makes sense. So, yeah, I definitely can't just choose one book. That's just way too hard. So I kind of took poetic license with the question and added a few.
It's your podcast.
So I think for me, when it comes to personal development, I remember many years ago, and this was back in my graphic design days, and probably before I even thought about studying holistic counseling, I was a graphic designer and had a really wonderful corporate business and loved my life and loved what I was doing. And I went to a shop in Paddington that was a bookshop and a cafe. It was back when they were starting to merge shops and cafes together. And I sat down and ordered a cup of coffee, and this book was just sticking out of the shelves, and I went and got it and picked it up and started reading it and ended up buying it. You could buy the books if you wanted to. Ended up buying it, and it was called Owning Your Own Shadow. And it was a really old book, and it was written by a man called Robert Johnson. And I remember reading it at the cafe and then took it home and kept reading it. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Like, we actually have this shadow side of ourselves that we reject, that we don't want to look at, that we want to disown, yet there is gold in it, and there's gold in the shadow. And I was so fascinated by it. And I think that really sparked my initial curiosity around psychology and wanting to study and learn more about psychology. And it wasn't long after that that I enrolled in studying those courses and did them. But one of the things that was really interesting in that book was he referred to a little example where he used Marie Antoinette. And as you know, Marie Antoinette lived in the Palace of Versailles, and she had a very privileged life. She wouldn't have lifted a finger for anything. She would have had the best of everything. And palace life, I think, eventually becomes quite boring. And I think she got bored, and she realized that there was a part of herself that she wasn't exercising, and that's called the shadow side. And the shadow side needs to be acknowledged, and it needs to be exercised in some way. Otherwise, what happens is, if you suppress it and you don't let it see the light of day, then it starts to kind of develop a life on its own, and it starts to seep out in unhealthy ways, and it starts to affect our behavior and affect our life in negative ways. And so I think on some level, Marie Antoinette acknowledged and recognized this. So she decided that because her life in the palace was so privileged, and she didn't do anything, wouldn't have done housework, or she wouldn't have cleaned a toilet, or she wouldn't have done anything like that. So she decided that she'd get her hands dirty, because she thought that would be good for her soul. So she organized for some milking cows to be sent over for her, and she had a barn built and she had some paddocks built, and she was going to start milking cows as a exercise, to exercise her shadow. And so she had all this built, and I've actually been to the Palace of Versailles and I've seen this barn and I've seen these fences, these empty fences. There's no cows there. And when the cows arrived, she just decided she wouldn't do it. She just thought better of it and didn't do it. And I often wonder if she had have actually gotten down and sat on a upturned bucket and milked those cows and gotten covered in everything that you get covered in when you milk cows. I had a cow when I was a young child, and my brother and I had to get up at 5 o'clock and milk the cow. And it's good character building exercises to do those things. And what I learned about the shadow is that you have to do, and I wrote about it in my book, I call it shadow work. You have to do shadow work, which means you have to get your hands dirty. And a lot of people, they become very wealthy and very privileged, and they have staff, and the staff do everything for them. And it's not healthy. It's not a good way to be. You need to get out and you need to shovel shit and you need to clean the toilet and you need to get dirty and you need to wash your car and vacuum and do all those things that are sort of gritty, grimy, dirty, sweaty tasks. And if you do that, then you're balancing out the shadow. And it's like everything has an equal and opposite attachment to it. So, and you know the saying where they say, no good deed goes unpunished. And that's because for every good, and that's what one of the things that that Robert says in his book is, have you had any good bad luck lately? Because all good luck comes with some bad luck. Like that's just the balance, the homeostatic balance of life, is that everything is balanced out, and our good qualities are balanced out by a shadow side. And if we can acknowledge that, then we stop projecting it onto other people. And a lot of people that you see that don't acknowledge their shadow, they project it onto other people and they judge. They become very judgmental. And then it's like, well, they're bad, but I'm good. And they do bad, but I only do good. You have to recognize that we all have a shadow, and we're all capable of evil, and we're all capable of bad deeds, and we're all capable of being our worst selves and our best selves. And when you actually merge those two things together and you accept that that's your psyche, and we're none of us are different, we're all the same, we all have the same ego, we all have the same psyche, and then you do your shadow work in your life, so you get down, get dirty, and actually roll your sleeves up and do a bit of a day's hard work, it's good for the soul. Mm. Really good for the soul. So that book was really, really inspirational for me.
What was the author's
and
name?
And then that was Robert Johnson.
Robert Johnson.
And he wrote Owning Your Own Shadow. I still have that book. It talks about religion as well, which is really interesting, and the cross and the symbology of the cross. And, quite fascinating. Definitely have a read of it.
That's good. I've never heard of that one, so that's good.
Yeah. And then another book that I really loved, Martin Seligman's work, and he wrote a book called Flourish. And Martin Seligman was the founder of positive psychology. Have you heard of him? He's scanning your bookshelves. Flourish.
No, I don't have that book. I just thought I knew the guy's name, but no, I haven't read that one either.
Yeah, so basically psychology used to be about a study about what's wrong with people. Let's look at what's wrong with people. And what I loved about Martin Seligman was he turned it upside down and he decided to study what's right with people. And let's look at what's making people's lives work out.
Mm.
And he developed the well-being theory, which I really love, which is abbreviated down to the word PERMA. And PERMA stands for 5 principles of well-being. And the first one is positive emotion. So we need to have positive emotion in our life. We need to do things that bring us joy, that are fun, that are luxuries, I suppose. Maybe a massage might bring positive emotion to you. Maybe going and lying on the beach or going for a walk in the forest or whatever it might be that brings about that positive emotion, we need to have that. These are the 5 principles of well-being. So if we tick all these boxes, these 5 boxes, then we have well-being. Mm. And Martin Seligman believes that well-being is more important than happiness. So positive emotion, the next one is E, is engagement. And engagement is when you are so engaged in something that that basically time stands still.
So the flow state.
Now, I love show jumping, right? And I love show jumping. So when I'm cantering into a show jump, I'm not thinking, did I thaw that chicken out for dinner tonight? You know, I am in the moment. I'm in flow. I'm not thinking about anything else. I'm engaged. And you need to do something that engages you. When you're about to hit a ball off a tee on the golf course, you're not thinking, did I turn the oven off or did I put fuel in the car? You know, you're not anywhere else but in that place, in that moment. That's engagement. That's second one. The R is for relationships. We need to have relationships with people, with animals. We need to nurture our relationships. We need to thrive in our relationships. We need to find joy. And relationships need to be a two-way street too. Like, they can't be a freeway and a bicycle lane, you know, where you're giving, 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 and the other person's not giving back. They need to be two-way. They need to be very equal. That's a healthy relationship. And relationships I could talk about for hours, but having relationships in your life is also really important. The M in PERMA is meaning. You need to have meaning in your life. Your life needs to mean something for you, and you need to do things that have meaning. And then the final one is A, which is achievement. You need to do things where you're achieving things, where you're setting goals, where you're striving, where you're going out and challenging yourself. You need to do things that stimulate you, that inspire you, that motivate you. So that's the five. PERMA is the five aspects of well-being. And I found that really helpful as well. And that's how we flourish in life, is when we find that sense of well-being. For mindfulness, Ellen Langer was the first person to really start to hone in on mindfulness and start writing about it. And she wrote a book called Mindfulness. And I loved reading that book because it really taught me about how mindless we are, like, most of the time. And everything that we do, like, how many times, I don't know whether you've done this, but so many times we're on tank water. So for me, I'm like the water Nazi around here. Like, I can hear a dripping tap. I can hear the pumps going. I can, you know, the last thing I ever want to do is run out of water. So for me, quite often I'll go and turn the tap off, but I'll do it mindlessly. And then I'll drive out the driveway and then I'll think, did I turn that tap off? I don't know if I turned that tap off. Or did, you know, and it's because we do things mindlessly. Like, how many times have you been looking for your sunglasses and they're on your head? How many times have you been looking for your mobile phone and you're actually talking on it? Because we're mindless, you know.
Right.
We're mindless.
For people outside of Australia, when Noni said she's on tank water, what she means is that you collect the rainwater off the roof into tanks, and that's your water for the house. So you've got to be very – Australia's a pretty dry place. You've got to be very conservative about water use. And it was interesting, Noni, I was on a plane – here in America, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago now, reading the in-flight magazine, and there was an article
on the
top 10 new green ideas for houses. And they had this amazing idea that you could actually collect the rainwater off the roof and store it in a tank. Like, I grew up on I grew up on tank water,
yeah.
You know, but this was in America. This was the other thing was dual flush
revolutionary
toilets. The other thing was revolution yeah. was dual flush yeah, toilets, yeah, yeah. which we've had in Australia yeah. since I was a kid
yeah.
too. So yeah, it
we
just
have,
depends
yeah,
on your on your experiences to whether something's new or old.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No, well, I've been on tank water for the last 20 years, so it's something that water is a very, very valuable resource over here. It's more expensive than fuel, so we have to be very careful and very mindful of our water usage. And so, yeah, definitely that. And like everything, when we're doing something repetitively, like driving a car, we actually switch that over to our subconscious mind, and our subconscious mind drives the car for us. That's why we're able to drive and have a conversation or listen to a podcast or think about other things. And quite often you'll be driving somewhere and you won't remember the last 5 kilometers that you traveled because your subconscious mind takes over exercises that are repetitive. And that's what allows us to become quite mindless, is that the subconscious does it, and therefore our conscious mind is not part and present. It's running off into the future, or it's worrying about the past, or whatever it's doing, it's not here and now in the present moment. And that's what we need to train our brains to do. And Ellen used some really cool examples. Like, she talked about when you're hoeing into a steak, you're not thinking about the animal. Like, you actually compartmentalize. So you compartmentalize that the cow is over there. That's a cow in a paddock eating grass, but that's not what I'm eating on my plate. What I'm eating on my plate is a steak that I got from the butcher. So you actually compartmentalize so that you can actually cope with things that you're doing and be okay with it. And she gave this other example of, like, for example, if you got a cup and you spat into that cup and you filled it full of spit, or, you know, put 20 spits into it, imagine then drinking it and you go, oh, but we're doing that all day, every day, because we're swallowing.
Right.
So it's just the way that we look at it. It's mm-hmm. the way that we view it. It's because we've compartmentalized it and we've become quite mindless about what we do, but we don't. If we actually thought about it, then we'd be quite horrified. But we're actually swallowing our saliva all the time. But if you spat into a glass and drank it and had to drink it, then you'd be squirmish about it. You'd be like, ew.
Don't say that again.
But you see the point? Like, it's really quite astounding, isn't it? Like, how mindless we are about things and how we compartmentalize things to make them more palatable, more digestible for us. So, yeah, her book's quite fascinating. I think for fun and romance, I like Elizabeth Gilbert, and I liked her book Eat, Pray, Love. I think that was quite good. And I think for understanding horses and the way horses are wired, Horse Brain, Human Brain was really good by mm-hmm. Janet Jones.
Yep.
I found that quite interesting, because a lot of the time you hear people saying, oh, it's, you know, this dumb animal, and why is it spooking at that? It's seen that 100 times. And I think if you understand the way that they're wired, I think that really helps to be more tolerant and more compassionate. And then finally, when I was studying holistic counseling, I sat in the classroom a lot because I had contemplating my life and reflecting, and at times feeling very guilty about things. And I had my first two sons when I was 20 and 24, and then there was a 15-year break, and the boys were 15 and 19 by this stage, and Steve and I were thinking that we were soon to become empty nesters, and here I was studying holistic counseling and learning about child self-esteem and child development. And I remember sitting in the classroom feeling very guilty about things that I'd done wrong and really beating myself up about it and feeling really sad. And I sort of said to the universe, wow, if I had the chance to do it again, I would do it so differently, knowing what I know now. And I feel like the universe heard that as a calling. And then before I knew it, I was pregnant for the third time. And I had a son 15 years after my last son was born. And I have had the opportunity to do it really differently and be able to put into practice everything that I've learned. And I have a very different, because I was raised by parents who were quite authoritative, and we were kind of not so much seen and not heard, but we had to really behave. Like, right. They were strict.
Yep.
And I parented my first two children that way, because you just basically copy.
Yep.
That's just what we do. We copy. And then I had time to learn different things and learn a different way. And then I had an opportunity to experience that with my third child, who's now 14. And I look at my relationship with him and the way that I've parented him, and I've never smacked him. It's just so different. And I remember reading a book by Dorothy Corkill Briggs called Your Child's Self-Esteem, and it's an old book written probably back in the 60s, and it's like all of those good old-fashioned things. Like, she just nailed it. And I think any person who's about to become a parent, read Your Child's Self-Esteem and learn how to nurture your child's self-esteem, because it wasn't done for us through no fault of our parents. They didn't know what they don't know. But there is a definitely a better way of parenting and a better way of doing it. And I spend so much time building my son up. I have a grandchild now, so I'm able to do that again as well through that experience. But I spend so much time building him up. And one of the things that really hit me, and one thing that I'd like to share with people who have children or are thinking of having children, is it's really important for them to see every day what they mean to you. And I can remember driving to school pickup with the first two children, and my mind would be elsewhere. I had a graphic design business at the time. I was probably being harassed by a client. I was probably thinking, quick, come on, get in the car. I've got to get back to the office. There's things I've got to do, you know. And I would have had quite a stern face. And I can remember them walking to the car and looking through the windscreen at my face to see if I was happy to see them. And I think to myself, I bet there was a lot of times when I didn't show that I was happy to see them, that I didn't look at them with excitement and smile and be excited about seeing them. I would have just gone, hey, boys, how's your day? Good. Okay, quick, jump in the car. Everything would have been quite mechanical, robotic. And that's the moment where they're looking to see how much they mean to you. And I missed it. I missed that moment. I didn't know to be more present for that and to really show them. And so now with Lincoln, with my third child, I'd drop him at school and I'd spend 5 minutes before I'd let him get out of the car telling him how much I loved him and how much I was going to miss him that day and how I'm just the most exciting thing of my day will be when I come to pick him up at 3 o'clock. Mm. And I'd leave my mobile phone in the car and I wouldn't take it with me, and I'd get out of the car and I would have a massive smile on my face when he was walking towards me because I wanted to show him how much he meant to me and how excited I was to be there to pick him up. And that's one thing that I can't go back and undo. And if I had have known then, I would have done it so differently. But I'm lucky enough to have the opportunity to do that now.
Yeah.
Not many people get that.
There's the whole nature versus nurture. So you really can't compare, you're not comparing apples to apples with your kids. But can you see a big difference in him because of the way you parented him than the other two?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
Yeah, and when you start doing unraveling your stuff, you know, when you have your midlife crisis, whatever it is, and you start to unravel your stuff, you realize how much of your stuff is not big T trauma, it's little T trauma. It's just the little, you know, not having your emotions validated and things like that. You know, I grew up in the whole boys don't cry era sort of thing. And, you know, what they say with like doing inner child work is you just have to go back and be the adult that your younger self needed at the time. And so, you know, what you're doing is so commendable because it's hard work. It's not easy because you have to be so mindful and so present. But it's not like you've got to, you know, you don't have to bench press your own body weight sort of. I mean, you don't have to bench press a car. It's not like hard. It's just a lot of little things that make a huge difference in the life of a child. You know, one of our presenters at the podcast summit the other day is a fan of a guy named Terry Real. You ever heard of Terry Real?
No.
I see him on Instagram a lot. He's a marriage counselor, I think. But he says parents fight in front of you and repair behind closed doors. And so one of the things we don't learn how to do is repair after an argument. You only see the arguments, you don't see the repair. Mm. You know, just all sorts of things like that.
So the
validating emotions is probably a huge one. I mean, anybody our age in Australia pretty much grew up without them being validated. And it's funny you said you weren't as happy to see your kids as you could have been. In my experience, in my era growing up, and I'm not talking about my parents, I'm talking about every parent, was bloody kids. Like I can't remember anybody celebrating their children like, you guys are amazing. Mm. Like, bloody, what are you kids bloody doing? What are you bloody kids? You know, understand that there's another way.
It was an attitude.
There's another way to be. Mm. And there's it just... You know, an analogy I've heard about life, whatever, is you're born with this bright light And as the stuff happens to you, these silk scarves just get put over the top of that light and you get enough. They're not very thick at all. They're very thin. They're see-through.
Yeah.
But you put enough of them on there, it dulls down your light and you don't have to get more light. You just have to pull the scarves off. And I think a lot of those scarves little things as kids are some of those scarves. Mm. And, you know, I was just interested to hear how Lincoln is compared to, I don't know, the other two and the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very different. And I notice how differently I handle every situation that comes about. If there's something where he's falling behind at school or a teacher rings me about something, and then the way that I then take that to him, like I would have with the boys, I would have been cranky about it. I would have made it their fault. Yep. You know, but when you said a minute ago, validating emotions, that just made something else come to me as well, is that as parents, quite often we can't bear to see our children's pain. And so if a child falls over and they graze their knee, the initial response is when they're bawling their eyes out is to go, oh, come on, you know, that didn't hurt. You'll be okay. That, you know, it didn't hurt that much, you know, while blood's pouring down their kneecap. And I learned that you have to validate that. You have to say, hey, that really hurt, didn't it? I can see that that really hurt you. You know, let's go and give it a wash and cuddle them and let them cry and let them express that, let them experience that. But we always want to deflect it because we can't cope with seeing them in pain because it initiates our pain. And until you've dealt with your grief, and I really learned that when I was studying counselling, I had to really deal with my grief and I had to counselling is all about becoming a clear vessel and you can't help somebody until you've done all the work on yourself. And I did 3 long years on myself and it was hard. It was really hard. But, yeah, being able to validate, and one of the stories that really stands out to me is the story about the emperor moth. Have you heard that story?
No.
About the emperor moth and the scientist that gets the emperor moth and he's got it in his lab and it's in its cocoon and it's trying to get out of the cocoon and he watches it struggle for 3 days and he's like, I can't deal with this anymore. This poor thing is struggling to get out of this cocoon. I'm going to help it. And he gets some tweezers and some scissors and he cuts the cocoon open to help the moth because he can't bear watching it suffering. And the moth just flops out and lands on the table and it's just like a gooey mess and it just like dies. And what he learns later is that the struggle is what's needed for the moth to develop the aerodynamics that it requires to be able to fly.
To be a moth.
So if he'd have just left it and let it struggle, it would have actually come out of the cocoon and it would have spread its wings and it would have flown. And that's what we have to learn as parents. If we have to let them struggle because the struggle is what is going to strengthen them and the struggle is actually going to help them in the long run. So don't always try and take their pain away. Don't always try to deny them the struggles and the challenges in life because you're not helping them. And that was really important for me. So, yeah, definitely some big learning there and some very humbling, very, very humbling moments studying that course. And then the other question, I've got to let you ask the questions, haven't I? I've got the questions here and I'm jumping ahead, but I'm kind of.
I just want to tell you another interesting factoid about raising boys.
Yeah. Please.
I was listening to an audiobook a while ago called Healing the Shame That Binds You by a guy named Bradshaw. In there he was talking about that most of the time, at least in the past, boys' emotions were not tolerated. You weren't allowed to express exactly how you felt.
Mm.
Okay. So before we go any further, does your husband get the man flu?
Oh, so badly.
So badly. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
This explains the man flu. As boys, you are not allowed to express exactly how you feel unless you are sick. And then you get recognition, you get connection, you get attunement when you express that. And so
Right.
suddenly when I was listening to that, I'm like, well, that explains the man flu. because you can't get it. You get conditioned not to be able to express your needs anywhere else, but that's the one that's available. So
except
it sticks with you for the rest of your life. And like your wife gets the cold and she's operating on 27 cylinders and you get a cold and you're going to die.
Yep.
And that, that explains man flu.
That's why. Mm. That's amazing. And so, like, unconsciously, he milks it. Is that why last time he was on the couch for 7 days, yet I had, like, 7 hours?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Makes
because
sense.
It comes
it totally
from that very
sense.
Young place. And that's one of the ways you get – one of the ways you get your – you know, it's one of the places your needs are actually met, your emotional needs. Your
met.
Yeah, they're met. So, it's you know, you're hardwired to – almost extort that, or you know, you're hardwired
milk it a little bit
because that's a that is a you know, that's a human need and you know, you raised
a genuine
to be the man
excuse.
And you're not supposed to whatever and whatever and so you get it where you can and that's one place you can get it.
Yeah, but I have to say that my husband, we've been together for 34 years and he hasn't milked it very much. He's rarely, rarely sick. So he must be able to find that recognition and permission in other ways. I don't know what it is. But he doesn't milk it too much. I could probably count on one hand how many times he's been sick in 34 years.
Well, that's his only...
But I really understand what you're saying.
Yeah, that's not... Well, that's more an indication of his health.
yeah, absolutely. But also, like, maybe, you know, for somebody who's not getting that, receiving that, might just have a headache, but then that headache is explained and... It's for everybody else, it's a massive migraine.
Right, yeah.
You know, like they just say they push it that bit. Mm. So to be able to get that, I mean, it's really sad, isn't it, that men aren't able to express emotions and that they're, and I think that it starts from a young age. It's like, oh, come on, you're being a girl.
Right.
If a boy expresses himself in some way. And it's like, well, I hear that a lot amongst men. And I think to myself, like, well, why aren't boys allowed to express their feminine side? Why aren't they allowed to show vulnerability? Yeah. Why aren't they allowed to, like, that's actually a part of being human. We're dehumanizing them.
Yeah. I've been to like a men's emotional resilience retreat, and that's a big part of it right there. That's a big part of our screwed upness is not being allowed to express our emotions. But anyway, I think you're a wealth of information on books. You got any more books before we get going to another question?
Not in that section, but I will talk about another book in one of the other questions.
Oh, okay. Well, I better get to the other questions and let me flip my page back over. I was ready to take notes about all these amazing books. What's your biggest failure and how's it helped you?
So I picked that question because I don't really think that there's such a thing as failure. Mm. Well, maybe failure is like a short-term description for something that you haven't yet achieved. But I just think that if you're in the arena and you're attempting something, then you've already won. And I think the only failure, if I was going to try to align a meaning to the word failure, the only way I could see it as being relevant would be if you define yourself by it or if something defeats you, I think then. And this is where I was going to talk about another book called, have you ever heard of the book Wolfpack?
No.
It's probably more directed at women, but I think it really is a book that is of value to men and women. It's by a woman called Abby Wambach. And Abby Wambach was asked to do a graduation speech in 2018 to a group of students graduating from college in America. And it went viral. It was massive. And she's a 2-time Olympic gold medalist and a female soccer player. She's FIFA World Cup champion and she's an amazing woman. And in her book, Wolfpack is an amazing book. It's about It's about creating new rules. She compares the old rules with the new rules. For example, she refers to Little Red Riding Hood and how Little Red Riding Hood is taught to stay on the path. You know, don't divert off the path, just go straight to Grandma's house. And she's like, no, let's not do that. Let's create our own path. You know, let's not be Red Riding Hood. Let's be the wolf. And we need a wolf pack. And she talks about supporting each other and having a pack. And it's a really, really good book. Mm. I loved it. It's not a long book, but you can get it on audiobooks. And, okay. and she reads it herself on Spotify. Spotify now do audiobooks. And Abby reads it herself. So if you've got Spotify Premium, I fully recommend listening to Wolfpack.
I do Spotify.
And one of the yeah, it's really good. And one of the things that she says in her book is make failure your fuel. Mm. And I like that. I think, yeah, like make it your fuel. So if you're failing at something or falling short, use it as fuel to motivate you and to get you to the place that you want to arrive at. So, yeah, that was my answer to that question.
That's good. I got four good books I hadn't heard about before. Okay, most worthwhile thing you've put your time into, something that has changed the course of your life?
Definitely working on myself. I first decided to study holistic counselling because I thought that I had my life so together and I would just be amazing at giving out advice and telling everybody else how to live their life. Why are you laughing, Warwick?
Oh, my goodness. It's like when the student's ready, the teacher will disappear sort of thing. You thought, yeah, I'm good. I'm good for this.
Oh, that was so humbling. I can't even begin to tell you. It's like I was stripped away, completely stripped away. So the first part of the course was to do a communication skills course, and we had this exercise of having to listen to somebody tell an experience that they'd had that was upsetting to them. And so I listened to this woman talk about her experience, and I did the typical thing that people do when they don't know. And I did this all my life, and people out there probably continue to do it every day. And that is, it's called share a like, which is you hear a story and then the next thing you do is you say, oh, that happened to me too. You won't believe it, but da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you start to go into your story and you're sharing a like, thinking that that's going to make them feel better, that you're going to align with them, and it's actually the worst thing that you can do. And it makes the other person feel terrible. Have you ever gone to talk about something really emotional to you and then the next thing that your conversation gets hijacked? And the other person interrupts you and starts telling you about how that happened to them. Have you had that experience?
I think I'm actually the hijacker more often than not.
Yeah.
And well, you know, and recognizing that's part of the journey, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But this is what I was so shocked to discover, that what I was doing that I thought was really good and was really making me kind of like in alignment with this person. Like, why are they upset that I'm sharing a like and sharing that happened to me as well? But what it is, the best way to communicate is that, and my husband always says, you have one mouth and two ears, and that's for a reason, is that we're not good listeners, and that's why we're given two ears, so that we can listen better. And all you need to do is just listen to that person and let them tell their story and just empathize. And just all you have to do is let them know that they've been heard. Like, everybody just wants to be seen and heard. So if you see that person and you hear their story, that's all you've got to do. You don't have to jump in. You don't have to hijack. So I really hold back now. And it's that, and like, it's not a bad thing. So if you are the hijacker, like, don't feel bad about it. All it is your little inner child being excited and wanting to be heard. And so you're like, you've heard enough of their story. It's like, it's my turn, it's my turn, it's my turn. And you just want to jump in. And so becoming aware of that and being able to hold back is, it's hard to do initially, but then you get better and better at it.
Okay, so I have a question for you. You have a podcast. Do you interview people in your podcast or you just talk?
I mostly just talk. As you've probably discovered, I'm pretty good at it. I go on and on and on and on and on. My husband often says I talk too much, but I have only done a couple of interviews.
Because that's where I kind of struggle. Every once in a while, we'll get an email, some feedback. Like I had a podcast on recently, and I got an email the other day. No hello or anything. It just said, "I felt sorry for this person. You wouldn't shut up."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No,
But it's, you know, this is a recording of a conversation, an exchange of energy and ideas between two people, and it's, you know, and sometimes. You know, sometimes I get it wrong because you got to fill in the blank spaces and you got to kind of keep it all going. And it's, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do it. But yeah, sometimes I get it wrong on this and I want to share a bit too much or do the like thing again, whatever you're talking about there. I don't know if I struggle with it, but it's, you know, it's supposed to be a conversation, so we're supposed to kind of have both sides going here, and sometimes I do a bit too much.
No, so you're taking it out of context, because what it is, and I said originally that we had to share a story about something that was emotionally driving for us, right? So you imagine that a friend comes, this is a different situation. A podcast is a two-way conversation. I've listened to your podcast. If I thought that you hijacked or you took over, or that it wasn't a reasonable exchange of ideas and information, that would irritate me and I probably wouldn't listen to it. So, no, I don't think that you do the wrong thing at all. I think you do absolutely the right thing. What it is if a friend came to you and wanted to share something that had just happened to them that was devastating, right? And they sat down with you and they said, "Warwick, you won't believe it. You know, I've just found out that my wife's been cheating on me for the last 3 years, and she's just told me that she's going to leave me. And you know, I'm devastated. I don't know what to do." And you then jumped in and said, "Oh my God, well, you wouldn't believe it. Robin and I had a fight this morning." Right. "And you know, she told me," right? So see how you haven't been there for that person and you haven't let them. Right. So that's the situation. And that's what we had to do with this communication skills, was we had to be there at a place where we were just listening to the other person and seeing how good we were at listening. And I realized I was really bad at listening, because I was listening, but most people listen thinking about what they're going to respond. So they're not really paying attention. And then they can't wait to respond. And it's all about them. It becomes all about them. I was guilty of that.
My wife and I have a little practice we were given by a therapist a while ago, to where once a day you sit down and each of you gets 3 minutes to talk. No more than 3 minutes, it's too hard to remember, but you get to say how you're feeling, what's on your mind, whatever. And at the end of your 3 minutes, the other one has to say, "What I heard you say was," and you repeat it back to them. You're not trying to solve the problem. Mm. You're trying to address the problem.
Yep.
You're just trying to say, "What I heard you say was."
Yep.
And then you both do that, and then you both tell each other three things that you're grateful for. And it really helps with the listening skills, because you have to repeat it back at the end.
Yeah.
And so you can't be and you're not supposed to be solving anything. And so you're not getting ahead of the conversation and trying to come up with the answer. You're just taking it in. And I have found that little practice start to bubble over into other parts of our relationship, to where we're not doing that 3 minute thing. I feel like I can listen a little better and be a bit more present in the listening, rather than trying to formulate my answer, you know, a bit more active listening.
Yep. Yes. Because you've got the task of reflecting back. And that's all you have to do as a counselor, is just reflect back, because people can solve their own problems. They don't need you for that. They just need someone to hear them so that they can hear themselves. Mm. And then they always have the answers within them anyway. We all have the answers within us. I always say that the only expert in your life is yourself.
I'm going to write down 156, because there's a point in every podcast where someone says something that is just so right on, and that was it right there. I love that you're just reflecting back to them, because they have the, so they can hear the, I forget exactly what you said, but you said you're reflecting back so they can hear the question themselves or hear themselves. Yeah, that was perfect. I love that.
Yeah, because we all have the answers in us. It's just that we need another human being to help us draw it out.
Okay, next question is, what do you feel like your true purpose is?
Well, I feel like the only real purpose that any of us have is to be who we're meant to be and to grow to love ourselves. I don't think that we're really born loving ourselves. I think that's a journey, and I think that's something that we all have to work on. I know for me, it's definitely been something that I've had to work on a lot. There's been times in my life where I've quite loathed myself and not felt good about myself, and so that's been something that I've had to really work on. I feel now that I'm at a point in my life where I do really like who I am, and it doesn't really matter to me so much what other people think of me, or I don't feel like I need outside approval. I give myself approval now. I'm 54 years of age. I think I've earned that. So that's something that I feel is our life purpose, really, is just getting to that place where we like ourselves, because we have to live with ourselves. We live with ourselves more than we live with anybody else, particularly in our own head. So if we can get to a place where we like who we are, then I think that that's probably our life purpose. I don't think it's so much external things. I don't think it's found through a job or a career or through anything that we do. I don't think we have to do something. I think we just have to be. And I think that's really important. And that actually brings up another book, which I didn't realize I had in here. But I remember going and seeing a woman speak, and her name was Bronnie Ware. And she wrote a book called The Top Five Regrets of the Dying. Mm. Have you heard that book?
I've heard of it. Or at least I've read an article
on it. It's fantastic. I heard Bronnie speak, and she was so inspiring. And so she worked as a nurse, and she was helping people transition to the afterlife. And so she sat with them when they were dying, and she had conversations with them, and then she wrote down what the five top regrets were. And they were, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. And then you think to yourself, how many times do you do things to make someone else happy when it's really not what you want? And another one was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard, because a lot of people spend all their time at the office, and workaholics is it's an addiction, and we often don't take enough time to spend with our family and friends and things that are important to us. I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. And there you go. That really relates back to what you were talking about with boys, just not having the courage to express their feelings, or not being given that space, given that time and that attention when they were little. I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. I think that's important as well, because quite often we let relationships go by the wayside, and these days it's all too easy just to send a text or to send a PM and not to actually pick up the phone and hear their voice. And then finally, I wish that I'd let myself be happier. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that we often feel like we don't deserve, you know, why don't we deserve? And that's one of the things actually that Abby Wambach talks about in Wolfpack. And she refers to somebody that came to train her once. And this woman said something to her was, you know, take the effing ball. Like it's your effing ball. Like take it, like take what's yours, take what you've worked for, take what you've earned. Don't step back. Don't hold back. Like it's yours. Like give yourself permission to have what you've worked for and what you've earned. And you'll hear more about that when you listen to Wolfpack. It's really, really good. And I think that's really important, is that quite often we don't give ourselves permission to have what really is ours by the divine nature of being human and being born on this abundant planet. So I found that book by Bronnie really inspiring, and I thought, I don't want to be one of these people that gets to my deathbed and has all these regrets. So I'm going to start putting that into practice in my life now, because none of us know how long we've got. And we tend to think that we've got forever, but life, that's the whole purpose of death, is so that we appreciate life. Otherwise, it would be endless.
Right. You know, that whole true to yourself and the courage to express your feelings kind of very closely tied with one another, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting, isn't it, that out of all the people that she interviewed, that was the top five. Yeah.
You know, and then hadn't worked so hard and stayed in touch with friends are almost a little bit connected too, you know, like too busy
aligned
for that.
As well.
Too busy for that.
Yeah.
I've got to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. Life is not a dress rehearsal.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. And you have one last question here. What quality do you admire in a person?
I think I had to think about this, and I think resilience. I really love resilience, and I love the fact that we're not born with a certain amount of resilience. It's something that we can actually improve upon and something that we can enhance in ourselves and we can grow. And I thought about, I know you asked about books, but I thought about documentaries and movies and things that I've seen that have really changed my life. And one documentary that I watched, it's on Netflix, and it's called When They See Us Now. And it's about the Exonerated Five. Have you heard of that story? The five black boys in America.
Weren't
and I know I say black
of
boys.
A
and there's.
Or a
yeah.
Sexual assault or something.
Yeah, they were accused of sexual assault and attempted murder on a white woman that was running through Central Park. And they were arrested and put into jail. And one of the men, Corey Wise, he is just an inspiration. And the only reason why he got arrested was because one of his little friends was in the back of a police car that was about 3 or 4 years younger than him. And he jumped into the back of the police car to escort this little boy to the police station so that he'd have somebody older with him. And he got nailed for it as well, just through being there. You know, that whole no good deed goes unpunished.
Right, yeah.
And I think they spent about 10 years behind bars until DNA testing came in. And then just one final thing. Anybody that's on Facebook, look this up or Google it. It's that show America's Got Talent. And this amazing man called Archie Williams, who, again, a similar situation. He spent 37 years behind bars for a crime that he didn't commit. It was actually a sexual assault and a murder. And he was put behind bars for 37 years. And the way that he got through that, he said, I was incarcerated, but I'd never, ever let my mind go to jail.
Mm.
And the way that he coped with it was he prayed and he sang. And so he sings a song on America's Got Talent. And if you get to the end of that song and you've got dry eyes, then, I want you to book in for a session with me because we've got some serious work to do.
That sounds
it's amazing.
You know, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl sort of thing.
Yeah, I read that book as well. Mm. That's a great book. Did you read The Tattooist of Auschwitz as well? Yeah, yeah.
I think
that's another really good book.
Somewhere, but.
Yeah, yeah. That's another really good book as well. But yeah, Man's Search for Meaning, Victor really highlights a lot of great things in that. Was just, yeah, you can't allow your mind, like, you know, your body can be in one situation, but your mind can be somewhere else. And I just think the people that are able to do that and able to come through victorious after being victimized like that is just, whew, that's some archetypal work right there. That's huge. I take my hat off to that. I bow to that.
Yeah, come out of it in one piece, but also come out of it not holding hatred for the people who put you there. That's got to be hard. That's that forgiveness one's got to be hard.
Yeah. Well, Jesus was an amazing teacher when it comes to that. I mean, I don't know whether a lot of what was written about Jesus is true or not true. Or the Bible's had lots of edits, and I'm not necessarily a religious person, but I know that it has been said that when he was being nailed to the cross that he did say, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." Mm. And to forgive your enemy and to forgive someone who's hurt you it's not easy to do, but you have to do it. You forgive for yourself, not for the person
right.
that hurt
Otherwise,
you.
Otherwise, you just carry it around with you. You allow
absolutely
your
resentment.
Head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Resentment.
Well, we're almost out of time here. So why don't you tell us how can people find out more about you and where can they get your book, all those sorts of juicy details?
Yeah, so my website is noniboon.com.au and everything's on there. The book Hollyfest is available on all online book outlets and, I'm available and contactable, and even if somebody just wants to flick me an email and just share something, I'm more than happy to. I volunteer my time a lot, and I like to respond to people, and I genuinely care about people. I'm lucky enough to be in a position in life where I don't need to necessarily earn money anymore. So everything that I do now just comes from a place of giving back and generosity. So
that's when it comes pouring in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what else was it going to say? Oh, is your book an Audible?
No, it's not. Oh, okay. No, unfortunately.
So I've got to read it. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, the reading's a little harder just because you're going to make the time.
It's only short, though.
It's only short. Okay.
It's short.
You know, because most of the books I read these days I listen to because, you know, traveling around trains, planes, automobiles.
Same.
Shoveling
same.
Horse poop.
Yep.
Can't shovel horse poop and read at the same time, but you can listen.
Yep. I know. It's so good, isn't it? It's so convenient because you can just but then we've just got to be careful that we don't kind of cram, you know. It's a bit like I always think of it like emails. You know, they come in, all that information comes in, and then you've got to sort of delete. Otherwise, you end up with a full inbox. Right. And every now and then it's good just to kind of delete it all. And it sort of still stays in the trash bin. It's still there, but you just don't have it sort of hassling you and beeping at you. It's a good thing to empty the mind at times.
Sorry, I'm just taking a picture of the most amazing sunset outside right now.
Oh, nice. Nice. I love this. Oh, yeah. Isn't that beautiful? Yep. Stunning.
Awesome. Well,
it's something that my four.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying my 14-year-old's obsessed with sunsets, and he has a little electric motorbike called a Suron, and he rides down to Noosa Main Beach and goes into the national park and photographs the sunset nearly every day. It's his favourite thing.
Really? I bet he's got a great collection of photos. Mm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful. Yeah.
So that's all that good parenting right there, having him appreciate nature and connect with nature and maintain that sense of wonder.
Yeah, look, it's still not perfect, Warwick, and I'm still learning and there's still many mistakes I make, but at least I've got a little bit of knowledge that I can draw upon, and it does help me a lot.
See, that there's having grace, understanding where you're at and where you got to go to.
Yeah. Yep.
That was awesome.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Noni. It's been great to get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, same. I've really enjoyed it. I feel like we could probably just keep talking for hours, but we should give the audience a rest.
We should. You guys at home, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.